Today's daf in Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, is Tzadi Gimel, beginning with a Mishnah, which in turn will begin with a classic introduction from one of the world's prized introducers, our very own Kapitan Richie. Please proceed. There you go. All those people who used to tune into the news just to hear Walter Cronkite saying goodnight to all the ships at sea, believe me, we'll tune into a Daf Yomi that begins with our Zukta Mishnah. So we're here talking about all of the different modes of Shi'ibudim and how they interrelate with each other in the case of Ktuvot versus the debts that are due, or debts that are due on loans, debts that are due for Ktuvot, the interrelationship of the Ktuvah Benin Dichrin as an inheritance, and so on and so forth. Let us talk about the direct issue of multiple claims against the same husbands from multiple wives. This guy isn't too smart, right? So he went ahead and he married three wives and naturally died. So Mishayana Suri Shalosh Nashim Vamet. So this guy marries three women and he dies. Okay, now, these three women have different types of ksuvas. And what happened was, I mean, this guy is really nutso because he did this all on the same day. Or he wrote out new ksuvas for all of them. But they're all coming with the same ktuva in terms of the date. So we can't say which one comes first. Normally, of course, if you have a lien, the earlier lien always takes precedence. That's by definition. But in this case, we don't have an earlier lien. All of these ktuvot are signed on the same day. Now, one of these wives has got a ktuva for 100. One of them has a ktuva for 200. One of them has a ktuva for 300. And all that this guy left over is 100. So what happens then? Well, all of these women have liens on that same piece of property, which is worth 100, correct? And therefore, they share it equally, 33 and a third, because it's exactly the same lien. And it doesn't matter the fact that, well, he owes me more, he owes her less, and so on, because what we look at is the way that the lien functions instead of the proportionality in a case like we would today perhaps talk about bankruptcy. What we're talking about over here is who is coming up in court against this property with a lien. All I know is, as a judge, is I see three liens against the same piece of property. I don't care whether the lien is part of $1 million claim or $100 claim. They have equal liens against this property, and they're going to split this property between them for those liens. Okay. Now, suppose there were 200 zuz that were left of property here in his estate. Then, now this makes no sense at all, and it's obvious that Rebbe is making up a nutty case in order to teach us some important halakhas. Remember, we do that very often. We make a crazy statement in a Mishnah, leaving it up to you to figure out what. So you either have to figure out an ukimta, which means you have to define a particular case where this will make sense, and it's a chiddush, or you have to say chisurei mechasra, and something like that. But, I mean, it's clear that it doesn't mean what it says. And that's one of these cases. Because here, absurdly, it says that in this case, the woman that had this ksuva with the one mana has 50, and the 200 woman and the 300 woman have the same, wow, three golden dinars. Not three golden dinars. Every golden dinar, they just found, by the way, a whole stack last week of golden dinars in the Galil, right? Where was it? I forgot what place it was. Barnea is not here today to remind us. But Barnea was right there, of course, when this happened, and undoubtedly took his share as a Kohen. But anyway, you can look these up. They're on the internet. And each one of those...
Where is the money, Mount Hermon?
Where? What?
Where is the money, Mount Hermon? It should be for us to eat. That's the
bucket. Yes, yes. It was, it was Byzantine, yes. But where was it found? In which forest?
By the Hermon, by Mount Hermon.
Okay, great. So is that Barnea's neighborhood?
Of course, it's the way the domestic, of course.
Not true.
Baruch Hashem, he didn't say he was taken out for dinner.
Okay, and Baruch Hashem, on his way to domestic, he did not have any epiphanies. That's good. He's still our Kohen Gadol. Anyway, so what happens over here is that absurdly, we say that the ksuva that has a mana takes 50. Why in the world would she take 50? How did it change from the 33 and a third? Because there were three claims against the mana. And why would the others take the three golden dinars, which are each one is worth 25 regular zuz? So that means they get 75 each and she gets 50. Makes no sense at all. And of course, the Gemara is going to ask, what the heck just happened? How did this work out? And now our final case, if there was 300 zuz, again, it makes no sense. The mana woman takes again 50, the 200 one takes 100, and the 300 one takes six of the gold dinars, which equals 150. Ah, now this is very interesting, because in this case, we have a proportionate 50% payout. Everybody gets proportionately one half of what it was that the ksuva was worth. Now, according to some Rishonim, the next words are only based on this case. And therefore, when it says, and I pointed out to you before, this is amazing, we are going to make a business insight dependent on a Mishnah that came to describe the payout of ketuvot. And therefore, when it says, the same thing would be if you had three people investing into a venture fund, and each one invests one 100, one 200, and one 300, and the fund either makes profit or loss, whatever it is, profits and loss are shared proportionately as this last case defined. Again, big machlokas, whether it's referring specifically to this last case, which is basically, as Tosis explains, Rav Hanano's approach, Rabbi Hanano, or whether it even includes the other cases of the Mishnah. We work things out according to Shi'i Budim, and so it's much more complicated. As I said, what's important for us is the beauty of the transition from ketuvot into venture capital directly. Now, I just want to understand what the heck is going on over here, says the Gemara, because this makes no sense. You say the mana takes 50. How did she get 50? She's supposed to get 33 and a third. There were three claims against that original mana, and that was the case in the first case. I mean, so how does the second case make sense? If you originally tell me they all have a claim against 100 and they all take 33 and a third, how did 33 and a third turn into 50? This makes no sense. So obviously we have to be talking about an ukimta, a particular case that's meant to teach us something. And we need to figure out what that ukimta is. Why did she not get 33 and a third and instead said get 50? Shmuel says, I'll tell you what the ukimta is. And man, it's a tremendous finish. The ukimta is that the woman that had the claim for 200 wrote out to the 100 woman, you know, I really feel bad for you. I mean, you're basically, we're all married to the same jerk, and you're basically left with nothing. And I feel really bad that you're going to have to face the rest of your life with, 33 and a third zuz. So you know what? I am absolutely not going to go and register any contest to your claims. And dinu dvarim en li'imach b'mana. I am not going to fight you on this mana at all. Okay? So because of that, we're only going to split that first mana between two women, between her and woman number three, who's got the 300 mana claim for her big ketuva. And that means each one gets 50, right? All right. So if each one gets 50, I mean, this sounds very simple because all she did was opted out. But it's not simple at all, because as the case as Shmuel is describing it, is what would have been, let's consider what would have been if she wouldn't have opted out of suing the first woman for a piece of the action, okay? So everyone would have gotten 33 and a third from the first mana, correct? And then the second mana would have been split 50-50 between the two women who had a claim against the second mana. And then the third mother would have gone totally to the third woman because the other women only had a maximum claim of 200. The other one, they don't have anything against this one, right? So then what should happen? She should have gotten a third woman, and the third woman didn't say anything. I mean, she's sitting there and saying, what the heck just happened to my money? I should have gotten 33 and a third from the first mana, 50 from the second mana, and the entirety of the final mana, okay? And instead, what's happening over here? In this case, it was only a second mana. Okay, so second mana, 50 plus 33 and a third, last time I knew how to add, equals 83 and a third. And now you're telling me I get 75 because I get 3 golden dinar. Well, thank you very much, but I want to know what happened to the rest of my money. How did we change 83 and a third into 75? How could the fact that woman number 2, who opted out of any claim, affect my 33 and a third from the first one? I don't understand. If she wanted to opt out, then she's got no claims against my full second mana, does she? How did she opt out and then come against me? She can't come against me. And amazingly, the simple shot that Rashi seems to provide, and that many people hold, is exactly what Rashi means, is that that's precisely what Shmuel is saying. What Shmuel is saying is, all I did, says the second woman, is I paved the way for her to stay out of the court. Now, whatever it is that she's going to do and she's going to be successfully pursuing in court is fine. Let her do it. She went after the first mana. Let her go after the first mana. So she took half of the first mana, right? Okay. Now, I have not been satisfied at all. And I have my original. Did I ever say I am mochelet on my claim? Of course not. My claim remains exactly the same. Where is my 200 mana ketuvah? That's my claim. So if woman number 3 comes to me and says, you are a jerk. Why did you pull out of collection? It's my business. I just didn't go to court. Okay, now I'm coming to court. Now I'm contesting your claim. And now my entire claim of 200 is up against the second mana that our jerk of a husband left us. So I say we split it. Exactly. And therefore, if we split it, even though you say, but it's your fault. So it's my fault. So what do you want? I still have a lien for my full 200 shekel. So, and what's left over here is 150 shekel. Okay, let's split it. We both have claims that take up the whole, you have a 300 shekel claim and I have a 200 shekel claim, but the lien is the same. And therefore I take 75 and you take 75. Now this is an amazing kiddush. So the fact that someone didn't pursue a collection in court doesn't give the right to someone else to say, well, it's your own fault. You should have. That's my business. I still have a lien that needs to be collected. You don't like it? Tough. This is apparently the pshat according to Rashi. But then the problem is, says the Gemara, then the rest of the Mishnah doesn't make sense. Let's take a look at the next case. How about if you've got, it says after that, the 2 and the 300 get 75 in each one of them. So why can't she say, and this is what the Gemara is going to explain the way Rashi understood it, why can't she say, didn't you take yourself out of all of this? And you said you won't contest it. And she answers, excuse me, what do you mean I took myself out of it? I said I won't contest her collection. That's all that I said. I withdrew from going to court. It's all that I withdrew from. I never gave away my ksuva. What are you, crazy? Did I ever say I'm mochelet? No. I said, listen, I really feel bad for you. I'm not going to contest this, but I'm going to contest it elsewhere. And it's exactly what I'm doing. So therefore, we split the remainder. Now, says the Gemara, let's look at the next case, because that doesn't make sense. We said if there was 300, then the ksuva of the mana takes 50. The ksuva of the 200 takes one mana. And the ksuva of the 300 takes 150, which turns out to be proportionate. Okay, I don't understand. How in the world did the woman with the ksuva of 200 suddenly take a mana when we just went through the same darn case and she only had 75? And now because you go ahead into the next case and you say there was 3 mana, but she had no claim against that last part. So how did she get from 75 to 100? Something changed. What changed over here? Didn't we say that we're talking about the case where woman number two had pulled out of any contest on the first mana, and she has no shibud against the third mana? So then we just said in that case, you get 75. And therefore, that's what she has. She's sharing the 150 claim with the woman who had the 300 shekel claim against that same 150, and they split it. So what changed now? Should be exactly the same as it was before. Omar Shmuel, no. Well, that's the whole point. Rebbe is forcing you to figure out what the case is. And in this case, the Mishnah is now talking about where the 300 zuz woman wrote the 200 zuz woman, what in the first case, the 200 zuz woman wrote to the 100 zuz woman. And she said, I feel really bad for you. Dinu dvarim ein li imachem. I'm not going to argue with you about that first mana. And therefore, she's the only one who was mevateret on contesting this in court. So then what happens is that woman number one and woman number two, they get 50-50 of the first mana. The third woman gets none of that because she pulled out. And then what happens is woman number two and woman number three both have equal claims against the second mana, which is another 50. And then basically this allows us to figure that the woman who had the 200 zuz ketuva took half of that first, which is 50, and half of the second, which she had equal claims on. That equals one mana. Fine. That must be the case. Rabbi Yaakov Minar Pekod Mishpeh de Ravina Amar. Look, you guys, if you're ready to accept an ukimta, this is a weird ukimta. Okay. I mean, because like you have to just, you're going to take a rabbit out of a hat to create an ukimta. I'm going to tell you of an ukimta that's much less rabbity. And in this case, you're only going to take a squirrel out of a hat. So how will you get that squirrel out of it? I'll tell you what it's talking about. The cases are different in terms of how many separate cases there were for collection. And that is a very important yesod. If you're all coming to collect simultaneously, then I understand that the Mishnah doesn't make sense. But suppose you're not collecting simultaneously. Suppose funds become available because the estate is being paid back slowly and it's growing. So first, what happened is that certain funds became available. So we all went after that. And then secondly, another tvisa, which funds became available. And let me explain, says Ravina. The first case, we said, meaning the first of the last two, the first case allowed us to have 200 zuz, right? And that's talking about the case where first 75 zuz were collected by the estate, and now we went to court. And when we went to court, we all, three of us, had rights to go and claim that 75 entirely for ourselves, because each of us had a minimum claim of 100, and that gave us equal rights to the claim against the 75, right? Okay, so then each one of us went ahead and took a share, and we all got 25 out of that. Now, what happened was is that afterwards, there was another piece of property that came. And again, it's a machlokas, when we're talking about pieces of property, we're talking about metatalim, according to some, how it was possible. Maybe the husband specifically made his ksuva on metatalim. Again, this is a side issue, which is quite complex. Let's just assume that the estate grew in terms of property and went after it. And then we found another 120 came in at a second time. And now we're all going after it. Okay. Now we're all going after it because we all have an equal claim in this new tvisa. Remember, we have to start figuring what is left in our claims. Now let's start all over again. Okay. Starting all over again brings us different amounts. We all only got 25 out of that first 75. That means that each and every one of us is going to claim, first of all, against the 75. I'm on 75. No, I'm on 75. I'm on 275. Papa Bear. No, sorry, I got the wrong one. So now what happened is that against that 75, okay, we still are going to divide that 75 between all of the three, which leaves another 50. But the other 50, the only claims against them were woman two and woman three, because woman number one has been totally satisfied with her claim, so to speak, because she can't go beyond the 75. So in this second visa, she says, okay, I give up. You know, I've got two other contestants. Masha Inkin, if you've got the last 50, because 125 fell at one time, that's going to be only split between the women that have the bigger ksuba. So let's figure, they first had gotten 25, then they came with their new claim for the first 75, that we divided, so now they all got out with 50. And the last remaining 50 is only going to be split between the 200 lady and the 300 lady. So what happened is, lady number one got 25 out of the first 75 that fell. She then gets another 25 out of the 75 that she is suing for, where she also has a claim. That gives her 50. The other two had claims for an additional 25, and therefore they all get 75. Between the two of them, they get 75. And that is shows you that every new time that you collect is, in fact, a new case. And we don't say, but you already got 20. That's not how we look at it. So we take it, and that explains why it is that we end up with what appeared to be unexplainable amounts. Now, let me tell you what the third case is in the Mishnah, where 300 zuz ultimately fell, but fell in pieces. So again, over here, first 75 zuz came into the estate. They all went and sued for it. They all got 25. Then another 225 fell again. So then that means that they're all coming to sue against the first 75 of that amount, which is the same as the previous case. And then the next 100 is going to be divided between two women with larger ksuvas. And then the last 50 belongs entirely to the woman who had the 300, because they don't have any claims against that last little bit. So all of them already got 25. They were left with their 75. They then sued again for the 75, out of which they all got 25 when there was a new property. And now the second woman, she started with how much being owed to her? 175, because she had only been collecting 25 from that first fall of 75 zuz. So she still has a claim of 175. 175 basically means that she's got a lien even after the first 75 was split. So she can now split it completely with the third woman, which leaves only another 50 that she did not have any claims on, 225 out of the claim she had on the 175 leaves 50. The 50 is taken by the third woman. And that explains that each one of them ends up with a proportion of 50% of her original claim. Says the Braita, and we'll finish with this, Tanya, Zo Mishnat Rabbi Natan. This is a very complicated way of working out claims that are based on the extent of the liens. And that's Rabbi Nosson's Shita. But Rabbi holds, this is crazy. Liens are total liens. There's no such thing as arbitrarily saying, well, a woman who only has 100 shekel worth of liens can't touch the second piece of property if there's a first piece of property. Who made that up, says Rebbe? All of these properties are the same in terms of the level of the she'ibud and in terms of how encumbered they are. You do not look at another she'ibud that's coming in the case as an encumbrance to another person. So basically, they all have claims against the entire set of properties. And what Rabbi Nosson is coming up with is pretending that the conflicting claims turn the piece of property into encumbered property because the other woman has a claim. Who cares? It's the same claim. Therefore, says Rabbi, they divide the estate. I don't care what it is. And because of that, they are chokot b'shaveh. They're going to actually split everything that they have a claim to. Okay, this is Rashi's approach. So the next thing that we had in the Mishnah was that we utilized the situation of the ksuva and the collection of a woman to talk about venture capitalists, people who put in money and they put in different sums into an investment fund. And if they had any losses or any profits, as the Mishnah says, it follows the same way that we deal with the woman in the Ksuvah. And according to Rabbi Yochanan, then did we always deal with things proportionately? Now, we have a very surprising psak by Shmuel, seems to ignore the Mishnah completely, in which he says that we do not deal with things proportionately. Omar Shmuel, Shnayim Shitilu Lakis. So let's say two people deposit money into an investment fund. One deposits 100 and the other one 200, right? So now, according to what the Mishnah says, we ought to have a proportionate takeout. And yet, Shmuel says that the Sachar is Lamza. If you've got any profit, then it's split equally, despite the fact that people put in different amounts, which is weird. Oh, my Rabbah, well, it's Mistavra Milti de Shmuel B'shor L'Charisha. You made the Charisha. So when they first invested, they invested in a shor. And this shor basically was meant to be rented out, to be used for plowing fields, whatever, you know, drawing things, whatever you use a shor for. And it's actually what it is that we're going to be doing. Now, in that case, you could say that it makes sense that everybody shares equally because there's no such thing as a half a shor. So, or three quarters of a shor. So, in other words, if I invest with you, we understand that my piece is precisely as important as your piece in coming to rent out this shor. So then it makes sense to say that the understanding, unless obviously, I mean, any agreement that they would have come to, they come to, that's a given. We're talking about where there's no agreement. So if initially it was to buy a thing that is only usable as a unit, so then if that's the case, it would make sense that they could split it evenly. But certainly Shmuel would not have said that, let's say you buy a shor and then ultimately you decide, you know, this thing has gotten so fat, we ought to shecht it and sell it. But then, I mean, you own different amounts of the shor, if you're talking about the actual body of the shor. So then, zenotel meotav, v'zenotel lefimotav, each one of them should take proportionately, like our Mishnah says. Whereas Rabbi Hamnuna says, even in the event that afilu shor l'charishav omed l'tvicha, asachar le'emtza, that if they didn't make any kind of deal, then according to Rabbi Hamnuna, we split it equally. And as a matter of fact, there are even Rishonim who say that the point is not necessarily this case, the way that Rashi explained it, which is that we're talking about where there's no such thing as three quarters of a shor, and therefore everybody should have the same amount. But even if we were investing in, let's say, washing machines to sell, right? To sell. And we're going to have like we're going to open a store for selling washing machines. So unless they stipulate otherwise, we always take for granted, according to some of the other Rishonim, that when people invest, there are a lot more issues to take into consideration than just the plain amounts of money that are invested. And unless people make a deal, which of course is the norm, that they'll write out a contract as to how they're going to be splitting profits and loss. But the idea over here is that we're always taking into consideration the partner's particular talents in a particular kind of thing. So in other words, if I go into a deal with someone and I do not in any way indicate that I expect other than a straightforward partnership in which we're equal partners, then we are equal partners. Because the assumption always is that I want you as a partner. So in other words, I trust your business acumen. I trust your experience, or I trust that you're a person with better mazel than me, or you're a person who has more skuyot. I don't know what the guy is thinking. But if there's not any agreement, there's lots of reasons why people will only feel comfortable going into a deal with a partner, a particular partner. So in that case, it isn't such a fundamental factor if the people don't recognize it between them that the money is what it's all about. It's not always about money. This is a completely different approach. Rashi's approach seems to be entirely in terms of the idea of you can't rent out 3/4 of a shor for plowing. And so therefore, if I accepted you as a partner, it's because I couldn't afford the whole thing, and it's worth it for me, and we'll split it. So unless we're actually going to be eating the shor, we're not going to split according to the proportion. Now, the problem is that what Rabbah said is not so clear at all, because there's a braita that says shnayim shetilu lekis zeman v'zematayim hasachar leemsa, and it doesn't make any kind of distinction. It says we just go straight down the middle, and that seems to be referring about either one of the cases, whether we ended up using it as a rent-a-shor business or we ended up using it as an eat-a-shor business. And if it's an eat-a-shor business, then even though we're selling shor and you own different amounts of the shor, seems to be the same thing because it didn't specify. My love, b'sholach harishavo made letvicha. By the way, the Rishonim speak out that in the event that the partners are going to eat the shor and they're not going into business to sell shor, so then for sure everybody would agree that they own a proportionate amount of the actual shor. It's only a question of what the understanding was, the business understanding. And so it's a teyuv to the rabbi. If the braita doesn't make any distinction, says the Gemara, not necessarily, because the braita may take it for granted that you're understanding the case to be a shor l'charisha, the omed l'charisha, and therefore the income is from the actual rent-a-shor company. So just one second over here. So in other words, what you're claiming is that if it was a shor l'charisha, and in the end you use it for meat, so what would be the din? You're implying that in that case, that then we would split proportionately? Then how do you understand the continuation of the braita? At a tani seif, instead of adding on an additional case at the end of the braita, where it says, if one guy buys shor with his money, and one guy buys shor with his money, and then they partnered up to have a larger shor rental company. So then what happens? I mean, this guy, obviously, he's putting in half the amount of money. So he's got either half the number of shvarim or he's got very weak shvarim compared to this other guy's super duper expensive and powerful shvarim. So then it still says over here, in that case, but only in that case, so then they split proportionately, right? But if what you're claiming is that even if it would have been the same business that was originally meant to be the rent-a-shor business, and then they simply went ahead and decided that they're going to make it an eat-a-shor business, meaning they're going to be selling now their shor as a butcher shop, so then that's what you should have said. Why did you make a whole big shebang at the end of the braita where they had two separate investments and then they put the investments together? I mean, you have to make it so complicated. Just say that in the event that they decided in the end not to use the shor, rent the shor business, then they would split proportionately. So you see from here, but since it wasn't liftog v'lisnei b'didei, it didn't make a distinction in the same case. Namely, when do we say that we're going to split down the middle? That's only where we originally invested in a shor rental business. And we end up actually doing that business. But in the event that it was a shor l'charisha, and in the end it turns out to be letvicha, then we would go proportionately. So apparently, we were wrong in trying to explain away the braita according to the way Rabbah was learning. No, says the Gemara, that's precisely what it means. Stop getting hang up. And it's the braita is saying, look, do you understand that in a case where they initially had two separate investments and then they pooled the investment into a business, okay? So do we understand that in that case, nobody in his right mind would think that it's not proportionate? That's what it's saying. It's saying in any event where you're sharing in the actual shor, so then it's the equivalent of having two separate investment shvarim. Achinamika Omar. That's what it means. It means, when do we say that we split it straight down the middle? That's only in the case where it was a shor l'charisha and it was actually used l'charisha. But if the investment was l'charisha but ended up now to be an edershar business, then it's the equivalent of, that's all the price is saying. Then it becomes the same as having two separate businesses. Each one of them had their own shar, and obviously they were proportionate to the amount of money that they used to buy the shar. Don't have to speak that out. So then, of course, zenot elafimota, zenot elafimota, because they're two separate businesses, not just a mixed investment. That's what the Braita meant. Okay, this is a little bit pushy, you must admit, but at least we don't have a tiyuf dan rab. Now, the problem, of course, is the Mishnah, because the Mishnah, sure as heck, didn't sound to be saying anything like that. The Mishnah introduced proportionate profit and loss sharing, according to the investment. Says the same thing we would be doing with these ketuvot. So Tanan, the king, Shloshashi Tilulakis, in the event that they had a loss, Pichatu, or if they had profit, Otiru, they would share it exactly the way that we did the ksuvas. Okay, now I mean, assuming when you're talking about profit and loss, you mean profit and loss through the business, right? You ended up either having a profit or a loss. I mean, that's what people normally use the word. And the Mishnah says that it is not straight down the middle, but that it's always proportionate. So how in the world is Rava going to use, understand the Mishnah? Amrim Nachman Amar Rabba Bar Avuha. No, it's true. It does sound like that, but it's not what it means. When it says that they had a profit or a loss, it means something entirely different. It means that initially, these guys had the types of coinage that would be very difficult for them to get more full market value as on the face of the coin. The coins were rubbed out. They were poor quality coins. And it's difficult to get people to accept them. So what they decided to do is they're going to open up a business. And then in the course of doing business, they'll get somebody to accept one of these coins with one transaction. Another guy will accept another coin in the next transaction. Maybe not for the full value, but he'll give them a slightly better coin in exchange, whatever. And then as they keep doing this, they ultimately have managed to turn the low value coinage that they had. Remember, in those days, there was a lot of giving and take when it came to bringing it to your local shulchani. Your bank would argue with you about how much it's going to give you for this coin and so on. So that's what it means. It means that hotiru means that they ended up with greater value in the invested coins. And when it says that they had a pachitu, that they lost money, that's talking about where they used the coins that were originally all right, and then the actual government canceled those coins. So now what are those coins good for? Those coins are great for dealing with plantar warts. That's about all you can do with them. So you put them on the bottom of your foot when you got a wart, you know. So if you don't go in for talking the wart into going away and you need some kind of placebo, it's the most effective thing for warts. So what you do is you take an old coin and you put it on your wart. You know, you step on it for a few days and undoubtedly that's going to cure your wart. In any event, that's about all it's good for. So that a nice $100 coin, nobody's going to pay $100 for anymore. That's the loss that we're talking about. So over there, obviously, we're not talking about the business generating profit and loss. But if it was a real business, so then in Okinami, we would have actually shared it equally, and it wouldn't have been. This is what Rabbi's going to have to say, because otherwise he's contradicted by the Mishnah. And now it's time for a very special word from our very special Kapitan. Very dangerous situation, speaking about the varies, because once again, our supposedly non-sentient Zoom has put Doc right over his head and noticed that Doc is holding at one of those needles. And I don't know what's in it, but man, I'd be careful if I were you.
not on my screen, Rabbi. He's down in the second row.
No, no, you're probably using an iPad.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Listen, you know, you can't be intelligent on an iPad. I mean, you need a computer. Go ahead.
Zuk de Halek Mishnah.
So, you'll notice that our perek started off with a guy who married two wives. And then the next Mishnah was a guy who married three wives. And now this Mishnah is a guy who married four wives. So the trouble only gets bigger. Anyway, so in this Mishnah, Misha Yanasui Arbanashim, so the guy was married to four wives and he died. So then the order of collection is in terms of the order of the ksuva. So Harishona, so the first wife, has the first lien, and therefore she comes before the second wife, if we're going to start allowing them to collect or to vote from his estate. The second one, she's able to collect before the third one, just like all cases where we saw earlier that the wife has a din of a bal chob, so it's like a creditor's collection. A creditor's collection is always proportionate, is always in terms of the lien that they have at the earliest point. And then the second one comes before the third comes before the fourth, and so on. Now, the thing is that the first wife, if the second wife says to her, now hold on, honey bunch, before you go ahead and collect your ketuvah, I'm a little nervous because what if there's not enough left for me to collect my ketuvah? So because of that, she says, I want you to swear before you collect from the estate that you did not already get your ketuvah. Remember, we've had this problem where there's a taina on a woman that maybe there were tsrori, or maybe there was a the technical term is tsrori, but what we mean is maybe there was a safe deposit box in which our husband gave you money that we don't know about. So I want you to swear that you didn't already collect your ketuvah, because I'm nervous that if you take the ketuvah from the estate, so then there won't be enough for me to collect my ketuvah. And then when the second one comes to collect, then the second one, if the third one says, hey, wait a minute, before you take that, I want to make sure that you had a right to take it. So she has to take a shvua to the third one, and the third one has to take a shvua to the fourth one. But the fourth one, since all of the others have already been paid up, she does not have to take a shvua. So even though the yitomim, you would think, would be able to say, hey, wait a minute, we don't want you to go ahead and take the estate, swear to us that dad didn't pay you off. But the truth is that the halacha, according to this Tana, and this is going to be a big machlokas, as we'll see in the Gemara, and hopefully Gavi is not too busy here and setting up his swimming pool or whatever interesting things are going on over there, that he can write this down, which is that remember that we have a klal that we don't collect from the nechasim of heirs. But doesn't use the word heirs, use the word orphans. So this Tana holds that the idea of collecting from orphans means not Gilbert and Sullivan's orphan who's 85 years old, but rather kids who are orphans. And that's what we're talking about. In this case, we're talking about adults. So the din of swearing to the yitomim does not apply to adult yitomim. And therefore, according to the Mishnah, the fourth one has no one to swear to because the other women already collected. And the children who are adults have no right to force a woman, unless, of course, she was pogemet ktuvata, and she admitted to having some of the ktuvah paid off from before, she wouldn't have to swear. Now, benanas omer, does it make sense that just because the fourth wife is last, so then she gets away with murder? She also needs a shvua. Now, what in the world does that mean? The simplest explanation, of course, would be that according to benanas, the word orphans are Gilbert and Sullivan orphans. So that if you're talking about the Pirates of Penzance, then the orphans we're talking about are, could be 80 years old. And they say, how can you take from us poor orphans if you don't swear? Maybe that's what Ben Anas holds. So we're going to see in the Gemara what the machlokas is. with bananas. Now, suppose all of these ketuvot were written on the same day. So then whoever is earlier in the time of the day, now this is something we never heard of, you know. So instead of the ketuvah saying, B'shemi l'chodesh iyar, it says, B'chodesh iyar b'sha'a eser v'shloshim v'chamesh baboker. And the other ketuvah says, B'sha'a chadesre baboker. And the other one says, B'sha'a chad batzoraim, and so on. We never heard of this before. Until now, we've always been talking about the day, not the time of the day. But over here, says the Mishnah, even the time of the day. So I exaggerated because we don't really trust the minutes at that time because they did not have accurate measurements of minutes. They had accurate measurements of hours. So if that's the case, afilu sha'achat, zachtashi comes first. Because kacha yu kotvim b'Yerushalayim, that's the way they actually would write the all of their shtarot. They would put the time, not just the day. They would put in the sha'ot. Now, suppose all of them are dated with the same sha'ah, and there's only for all of these ketuvot, all four ketuvot, all they have that's left in the estate is $100, then they divide the $100. Nobody comes before, so they simply will equally divide.